Well, the heads have begun to fall. Michael Flynn, top national security officer, resigned. This was all self-inflicted for his lying, but it does bring the sense that some chaos remains in Camp Trump further, that you can get fired from this administration. And finally, with blood on the grass, the leftist hyenas begin to chatter, yap, and howl. Yet someone better will take Finn's place. And by the way, happy VD. No, not what you think. Happy Valentine's Day. And also, they're trying to get a handle on that dam out there. And what they found is what I had mentioned yesterday. Hole that was caused by that little small divot. As the water poured over, it became bigger and bigger until the entire spillway had a hole 250 feet across, almost as long as a football field, a depth of 40 feet, and it's probably 50 feet wide. So they've been dropping stones in there and rocks, boulders, whatever. And the fact of the matter is, well, somebody told me yesterday they were going to try to pour cement over it, marine cement that would be able to cure underwater and also would do so quickly, although I can't imagine that they'd be able to pull that off, because you know what? Another storm is coming into California. The Pineapple Express is bringing another load over, so... And anyway, happy Valentine's Day. I've got a little bit on that. I got a ton of stuff to get over to deliver for you. And, of course, the first of which is that Flynn is out. And that's too bad, because Flynn was a real critic of Islam and understood it and recognized it as a political movement masquerading as a religion. So, unfortunately, he's gone, but from what I can tell, he lied unnecessarily about some communications with Russia. If it was on the inside with Russia, then I don't see that Flynn would have ever needed to call up and talk to him the way he did. Anyway, here's a little bit about that sudden resignation.
Senior national security analyst.
This is from CBS.
It's Fran Townsend. Is a former Homeland Security Advisor to President George W. Bush. She joins us from Washington this morning. Fran, good to see you.
Good morning, Gail.
So let's go through this for a second. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Kellyanne Conway says that he has a full support of the president. By the end of the day, he's out. What does this say to you? What do you think happened behind the scenes?
Well, you know, in some ways, the White House just can't win. They get notified by the Justice Department, according to the Washington Post, that there's been this conversation and that Flynn might have misled them. Of course, if they had acted then, they might have been accused of obstructing an ongoing investigation. And so in some ways, if you're in the White House and you get this sort of a notification, it is a no-win situation. I don't think, you know, you had the Canadian prime minister there yesterday. You have Bibi Netanyahu of Israel there tomorrow. They couldn't have this cloud constantly hanging over them when they're dealing with such important issues. And so at this point, they, with all of this in the press now, it becomes a huge distraction, and it's unfair to the president, frankly. And I don't think they had much of a choice but to let Flynn
resign. Fran, as you mentioned, the White House was warned about this weeks ago by the FBI. And the specific concern that was relayed was that Flynn could be open to blackmail.
Oh, my God. You know, the media can't hide its bias, which is kind of sad, because it makes you tune them out. But he's out. Flynn is gone. And frankly, you'd rather have this happen now than you would in a year or two when you find out he lied a couple of years ago. So anyway, Trump did the only thing that was available, which was to fire him. Or maybe the guy just decided to quit. But at the same time, you've got to, so he was in a situation. He was asked some tough questions, or he was not asked a question, but there was an issue out there and he didn't bring it up, or he was asked about it and he didn't tell the truth. But he's got to go. So you can blame this on Trump. But, you know, the things that are that are going on with the president really, I mean, Flynn, it seems like, would have been a very capable and a very, very vigorous guy in national security. But so go find somebody else. I'm sure there's a thousand people like Flynn in the United States, maybe not with as high a profile, but people that are devoted to the country, who haven't drunk the Kool-Aid, who, and you know, it amazes me how many people have gotten up to the upper levels of politics on the left and the right, GOP, you know, the Democrats, Bernie Sanders, who's supposedly in the middle, but is really super far left. All of these people have drunk the Kool-Aid. How do you get it? How does that happen? Is it just, you know, you become adapted, or I would say they get seduced or corrupted, but I think they're corrupt when they get there, and it's just a new orientation for them, and that gives them the ability to band together, and when they ask for or demand certain things of the country they have no right to, like incredible overspending, deficit spending, leaving the border open, just leave the border open and see what happens. Leading from behind in the Middle East, the agreement that we had with Iran, all these different things that you get people to sign on to things that are insane, that are suicidal. It's because they're in the same inbred and deformed family, you know, and they don't allow themselves to think. So anyway, somebody will come in that was better than Flynn. And there's no doubt that that guy will be good, too, because Trump seems to really choose top-notch people. Now, I got a ton of stuff to get to today. And I want to give you an update on Oroville because I think it's important to, it's interesting. It's exciting. It's very, very, you know, this is weird. Just exactly what I'm talking about here. Jim Webb, the Democratic Party, has moved very far to the left. I feel sad, I feel sad for anybody who becomes a Democrat and says, I don't personally believe in abortion, but I'll buy into abortion so that I can be part of this party, you know? And there's got to be a contingent of people that have done that. But anyway, I was looking at another attack article from a guy by the name of Jeffrey Frank that I had never heard about in the New Yorker magazine, The Embarrassment of President Trump. And so you've got just article after article and story after story that all says the same thing from maybe slightly different angles. And you just have to wonder, I mean, these people all seem like Siamese twins, you know, these reporters, they're all there to tell you that Trump has already failed. You know, Trump failed the day that he was born. Trump is a fascist. He's Hitler. He is anti-democratic. He's anti-immigrant. He's a racist. He's a homo, whatever. And it doesn't behoove these people, even if that's what they actually believe, to get onto this bandwagon, because it makes them seem like clones, you know, not very bright people. But I was thinking about this morning, and I have thought about it for years. There is a group of people that have come together in the far left that set aside all study of history and logic to join into this leftist movement, the socialist Marxist movement. And you know, the upshot from that is that no matter what occurs, they never give it up, right? So it is indistinguishable from not only religion, but the worst kind of religion, Islam. Islam is obviously radically failed. It cannot run a country. It cannot create a strong economy. For the countries that are Muslim, that have any kind of a robust society, a robust nature, it's because they brought in ideas from the West. And so That's leftism. Leftism can't exist except as a parasite. If you were going to start a country, would you take all the ideas of socialism and use that as a foundation? No. I don't think most leftists would. Why? Because you never get it off the ground. Anyway, we'll take a break here. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 617 on the button, 523-1450 to call in. And you're listening to KOBE. We'll be right back. And I've got this clip from Jim Webb that I'm interested in hearing that just happens to be on the topic I was mentioning. The cult clan nature of leftism. All right, so this looks like a good, I haven't listened to the whole thing, but this looks like a good take on the problem that we're talking about, which is you develop a party system way back centuries ago. The parties develop and, you know, it's unmistakable and it's just human nature that the upper class gathers itself into an elite. And, you know, the Ivy League school system used to be the crown jewel of higher education for around the world and is still considered such, but they're producing increasingly mentally incompetent graduates who just carry on this politically correct ideology, this religion, and that's all they care about. And it's like, you know, when you've got a problem, when the government repeatedly chooses to fight global warming over building an economy, which is what I gather that Barack Obama did. You've got a problem when theory trumps reality. And so now we've got somebody who's come in to fight against this, and the left is in a tizzy, you know. And what exactly is the claim of the left that they have moral superiority over Trump? We've just endured 8 years of painful failure and a lot of accusations and absolute embarrassment. But these are the people that needed to have the country for the next 8 years. I mean, got to be at some point, some sense of reality in the Democrat Party. You know, it's just, what's the point? You're going to get your way and run everything, or you're just going to sit there and throw a tantrum every day and try to ruin everybody's experience of life for the next 10 years. Here is, that's not a way forward. It's just an admission of failure. Here is a little bit of Jim Webb.
A centrist and a moderate Democrat. Jim Webb was Secretary of Navy under Republican President Ronald Reagan. He voted for George W. Bush over Al Gore, but by 2006, he had switched parties to become a Democrat, and he won a U.S. Senate seat in Virginia. Jim Webb takes a somewhat more optimistic view of the potential for a Trump presidency, and he joins me now. Senator Webb, welcome back to the show.
Yep, nice to be here.
So let's put some context to your words. When you wrote an op-ed right before, literally the day before the inauguration of the Wall Street Journal, and it was mostly on foreign policy, where you're saying there's something about his election is a jolt the system needed, or shock that it needed. What?
Well, you know, in so many words here, I didn't say that the system needed a President Trump, but I've been saying for a long time that the system we're operating under needs some sort of a jolt. You know, I think both parties have sort of gotten calcified. And let's remember that if Hillary Clinton had won, you would be seeing the same sort of activities that you're seeing now. They would just be focused on different things. There'd be people out there saying she belonged in jail. There'd be people talking about corruption, turnstile government, et cetera, et cetera. So what we're seeing playing out right now, first of all, and as the governor mentioned, this is a new administration, you know, getting its wheels under it. But at the same time, this is an attempt by President Trump to pull different types of people into the system from the old turnstile government. There's a lot of Republicans that are mad at them. We're sitting out there in the think tanks thinking that they were going to come into a Republican administration. And also, he's got a payback, I think, that he feels strongly about in terms of the people who actually put him over. These voters that were alienated, were not voting, and these issues, the controversial issues, as he's pointing out, in the wrong kind of form, I think, are issues of credibility. On the Democrats, first of all, they're looking at 2018, and they don't have a message. They don't have a
speak to them as they, by the way.
Well, you know.
You don't say we. Is there a reason?
I'm not in the system right now. I'm over here with you right
Fair
now.
Fair enough.
I've
okay.
I've spent my life as a writer and a journalist, and it's a good place to be able to make those observations.
Then welcome back and finish the observation.
Well, you know, there is a campaign going on the Hill, in the media, in the academia, to personally discredit not only Donald Trump, but the people who are around him. Mm-hmm. And you know, the end result of this really is trying, and to slow down the process, by the way, you and I were talking a minute ago about the confirmation process, is slow it down so that by 18, when the Democrats are very vulnerable, particularly in the Senate, there will not be a record of accomplishment that they can run against. And at the same time, the Democratic Party over the past 5 or 6 years has moved very far to the left. You know, when you can't have a Jefferson Jackson dinner, which was the primary, celebratory event of the Democratic Party for years, because Jefferson and Jackson were slaveholders. They were also great Americans in their day. Something just different has happened to the Democratic Party.
You think they're too focused on identity politics?
Well, I think that the message that has been shaped by the Democratic Party has been shaped toward identity politics, and they've lost the key part of their base, the people that, and you know, my family history goes back to the Roosevelt Democrats, the people who believe that regardless of any of these identity segments, you need to have a voice in the quarters of power for those who have no voice. And we've lost that with the Democratic Party. I'm not saying the Republicans have it. But
I was just going to say the center's been hollowed out. You could make an argument that the political center in both parties, because right now, if you espouse that, you were running for reelection, any Democrat would.
I think you get the gist of what he's talking about there. So we'll take a little break here. I've got this great article I want to read you. And I also, I don't know if you, I've got a little bit of a history of Lupercalia, which is Valentine's Day. If VD, happy VD, is not just venereal disease, happy VD can be Valentine's Day. And I've got a little more on this dam. I got a couple of great articles to get into. I've just got too much stuff. But, and also 2 minutes of hate. Let me ask you just a general question. Do mobs appearing on the streets portend favor for the Democrats? If there's a mob mentality, if there are mobs rising up and throwing tantrums and breaking shop windows, you know, the stuff they all do, lighting cars on fire and beating people up, does that portend the strength of the Democratic Party or its weakness? Are people going to see these protests going on across the United States? And apparently Obama has bragged about having 30,000 soldiers in his protester army. Does that mean they're going to get back in power? 629, 628, Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 523, 1450. We'll be right back. All right, just to focus on Oroville just a little bit, the Oroville Dam. Now, remember that Oroville is the tallest dam in the United States. It's about 30 or 50 feet taller than Hoover Dam, which is, you know, the very famous concrete dam down by Las Vegas on the Colorado River that created Lake Mead. And so it's the second largest dam in the United States, or in California, the second largest, pardon me, reservoir. I'm trying to multitask here. But they had, if you weren't listening yesterday, and if you haven't been paying attention to the news, there was an issue that came up, which is kind of interesting, and you can decide who's at fault here, but there was a situation where a lot of rain has come into California through the Pineapple Express from the region of the, you know, South Pacific, Hawaii area anyway, and which is how it gets its name, obviously. And so that filled the lake up, and the lake had been down quite a bit. And so when the water came up, it was unexpected. I think it was unexpected, obviously, that rainstorm after rainstorm after rainstorm would come and build the water level so high. And Lake Shasta is also pretty high up there, too. And Lake Shasta has gotten, I was trying to figure out the information that I'd gotten yesterday on Shasta, was that 112 million gallons had come in during the storm cycle to Shasta. Now, Shasta can hold 4.5 million of water, which is different than gallon. And I assume bigger, that I'll have to go research that. But anyway, so here's the thing that happened is the water comes up and Lake Oroville Reservoir is an older lake, and it hasn't really been updated. So they had the spillway that was never used before, a massive spillway, which just happened to have a default in it, a defect that was not discovered to be as serious as it was until the heavy water came down. And so as the water came down, it dug out this giant pit, and pretty soon the spillway had failed basically in the middle, but not at the top. All right, and then so they started using the emergency spillway, which was done because it was to the lake was to the level where it started to naturally pour over this spillway. Now the spillway has concrete over the top, but as it gets over the edge, then it goes down and it gets into the dirt. So here's the interesting background of this, and I picked this up from I actually found the study that they had done, and I found about a 500 page book that they had put together from a lawsuit that started in 2004. And here's just a little summary of that. More than a decade ago, federal and state officials and some of California's largest water agencies rejected concerns that the massive earthen spillway at the Oroville Dam at risk of collapse on Sunday and Monday and prompting the evacuation of 200,000 people could erode during heavy winter rains and cause a catastrophe. Three environmental groups, the Friends of the River, the Sierra Club, and the South Yuba Citizens League, filed a motion with the federal government on October 17, 2015, as part of Oroville's dam relicensing process, urging federal officials to require that the dam's emergency spillway be armored with concrete rather than remain as an earthen hillside. The groups filed the motion with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they said that the dam built and owned by the state of California, finished in 68, did not meet modern safety standards because in the event of extreme rain and flooding, fast rising water would overwhelm the main concrete spillway, exactly what has happened, and flooding, fast rising water would overwhelm the main concrete spillway, then flow down the emergency spillway, which could cause heavy erosion that would create flooding for communities downstream, but could also cause a failure known as loss of crest control. Now, I didn't find definition of loss of crest control, but they go on to say a loss of crest control could not only cause additional damage to project lands and facilities, but also cause damage and threaten lives in the projected floodplain downstream. All right, all this stuff happened. Okay. So there was a failure, and they said that the debate was really over money. But I think it's kind of fascinating that they foresaw this. But then you look at a picture of the dam, and it becomes obvious. You've got the dam. Then right next to it, you have the spillway. Then right next to that, you have the emergency spillway. And you could see just by looking at it that if there was ever a flooding event, which is why you had an emergency spillway to begin with, the water would come over the spillway, and then it would erode the side of the hill. Now, the problem with that, obviously, is the erosion goes up, or maybe it starts at the top, which I think is what they're talking about, the loss of crest control. If the top of the dam fails, then the chances of the whole dam failing are pretty high. Wherever the erosion is, the erosion takes away from the stability of the whole dam. And so just looking at pictures yesterday, these guys were lucky that this dam didn't begin to fail, you know, because so much water in it. So, all right. So now, all right. So 24 hours later, we've got another rain that's coming into this area. This area is, I think, the upper valley. I think it's the Sacramento section of the upper valley, this world's greatest agricultural valley in California. All right, so here's a little clip from weather.com.
So we've been talking a lot about the various flooding situations that we have going on in California, and of course there are a lot of them. I know we've been focusing a lot on what's going on up around Oroville, but I do want to focus right now on South Central Sacramento County, where officials are saying that there is an imminent levee breach. Okay, so there was a big chunk that basically fell off this levee. This happened back Monday. They've been working on it ever since, trying to get some rocks and all that kind of stuff in there. They've got a lot of engineers working on this, but this is affecting Tyler Island. This is south of Walnut Grove. Anytime you see a tiny little flash flood warning like this, you can be almost sure that they're talking about either a levee that's expected to fail or a spillway that's expected to fail or something like that. This could even end up affecting eastern Walnut Grove, but I mentioned that Tyler Island has been evacuated, so that's one we'll have to watch closely. I know we're getting a nice little break from the rain right now, but guys, by the time we get through tomorrow and all the way through the end of the week, into the weekend, we're right back to what we've been seeing pretty much throughout this entire rainy season. More rain and more snow.
And we're talking about inches more rain that's going to be coming in. And I'm looking at the picture here, and one, probably an inch to 1 to 2 inches in that area. But, you know, so you got a dam that's on the verge of failing, and you need to worry about that in a huge way. So they're trying to rebuild this hill. All right, and I do have one. Let me just put on one clip here. Here's repairs on Lake Oroville Spillway.
Dave Allen, we've been seeing a lot of trucks go down there, and now the helicopters. What are you seeing? Where are they putting them?
A lot of trucks and a lot of helicopters. Matter of fact, Galston, you better duck because one is coming back your way, and that's what we're going to show you first. This is where Galston is, right down here. Now, all of those white things you see right there, those are all the rocks that they're going to have to move to these positions in the dam. And I'm going to go ahead, we're going to go ahead and see this helicopter come in right here.
All right, you can't really appreciate this because you can't see the pictures, but all right, so I think I've told you enough about that. It is very, very concerning that this thing is going on, and it's kind of astonishing that this whole failure was predicted over 10 years ago, and you just need to see one picture of this dam to understand that the danger was real then, and it's obviously real now. We'll take a little break here. I like Adele a little bit that I've heard, but I think if she chose better songs, she has an incredible voice. Here's a little Led Zeppelin, When the Levee Breaks. Kelly O'Connelly, I'm Les Cruz, 6:43. And it is Happy VD, Happy Valentine's Day. And appreciate you tuning in. I'm going to come back. I'm going to read you an article that I think you're really going to get a lot out of. And then we're going to do a little bit of the history of VD Valentine's Day. We'll be right back. All right, so I've got for you I have for you right here this article, but first let me play a little clip. And let's this clip right here is Nia Malika Henderson on Flynn resignation. Now here is the press, which thinks it's the most important thing in history, taking credit for.
I'm sure that you know there's someone in the White House who may be looking at this as a glass half full opportunity. Does this offer any type of opportunity to the White House?
You imagine some people might be looking at this as sort of a reset to get this story off the radar, off the front pages of papers like the Washington Post and the New York Times. And others might be looking at it as the press having scored some points against this White House. I mean, we know that this is a White House that has an ongoing feud with many different outlets. And so in that way, I imagine there are going to be a lot of different views in this White House. As we know, there are all sorts of feuding camps. I think one of the problems.
All right, so the press is giving itself a pat on the back. Now, this story here, let me play one clip from Trudeau. We'll take a break and then come back. And this is Trudeau, this prime minister from Canada. He looks like a mannequin, but he actually had some wise to say here. We'll take a little listen to this.
States have been neighbors a long time, And Canadians and Americans have stood together, worked together at home and around the world. We fought and died together in battlefields in World War I and World War II, in Korea, in Afghanistan. But there have been times where we have differed in our approaches. And that's always been done firmly and respectfully. The last thing Canadians expect is for me to come down and lecture another country on how they choose to govern themselves. My role, our responsibility, is to continue to govern in such a way that reflects Canadians' approach and be a positive example in the world.
Wise words. Stop trying to tell us what to do, other countries. Here we go. Take a little break here. Kelly O'Connell, and I'm going to read you an article that you're going to enjoy. 6:50 a.m. Las Cruces AM 1450, 523 1450. When the levee breaks. All right, so I don't know what's going on here, but the news kicked in early. But in any event, here we go. Today's riot-prone mobs are a product of America's cult-like education system. This is from The Federalist, and it's by a lady by the name of Stella Morabito. Now, there will be more street theater in the days to come. Every week after President Trump's inauguration, the headlines have been full of protests at local town halls for GOP members of Congress, campus events, counter-protesting pro-life demonstrations. If you are of sound mind and watch the anti-Trump demonstrations unfold on Inauguration Day, then during the recent anti-speech riots at the Cal Berkeley and New York University campuses, two developments probably stood out to you. First, you could see how violent rioters systematically infiltrated and punctuated these supposedly large peaceful protests. The black bloc presence and body language looks to this writer of the article is similar to ISIS terrorists, right down to the black hood and masks. Second, there's a strange cult-like feel to the behavior of these mobs, an incoherent blind rage, encouragement of lawlessness, and utter hostility to anyone who doesn't conform to their beliefs. It's an anger that is sustained by tactics reminiscent of the 2 minutes of hate in Orwell's novel 1984. Rather than acting as individuals who exercise rational thought, participants in these mobs act more like atomized parts of manufactured hives. They have been deployed at the drop of a hat at airports, town halls, campuses, to create the illusion of mass resistance to a duly elected president in his administration. Such mobs are aggressively pre-packing and swarming town halls of GOP members of Congress in solidly GOP districts, as we saw here in the Oregon Mountain so-called debates. They trucked in, they shipped people in from across the country to go to these events, which is pretty sad when you think about it. You don't have enough local people to support your ideas, so you have to, import them. Now, what's the purpose of this? All right, the hope, which is stated by the founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party of the USA, Carl Dix, as well as Princeton University professor Cornel West, who are founders of the George Soros-funded group RefuseFascism.org, is, quote, to mobilize tens of millions of resistors into the streets to bring down the Trump administration. Senator Tim Kaine recently gave his relatively moderate voice by calling for people to resist the Trump administration in the streets. And Tim Kaine, if you know anything about him and his history, is not that moderate. He was involved in a communist wing of the Catholic Church down in Central America. If aggressive mobs send out enough warm bodies through their organized pyramid scheme of recruitment, then law enforcement will be overwhelmed and have to throw in the towel, or that's the idea anyway. Well, those who are pushing for sustained street resistance are banking on two things. Number one, that the mainstream Americans won't realize it's too late and that we're in the midst of a virtual civil war that could turn violent. And the second is that agitators are betting that Americans will not have the stomach for a prolonged fight if they intend to bring this stuff into the streets. So how did we get here? Let's face it, today's street theater is the culmination of decades of radical education revision. The radical left's systematic attack on the study of Western civilization has been an attack against the study of any and all civil societies. It's an attack on the features that make a society civil and free. These features include freedom of expression, civil discourse, the Socratic method of finding truth, values of the individual, and common knowledge of the classics of history and literature that help us understand that we're involved in a universal human undertaking. Now, and I'm not going to have enough time to finish this, but if you think about what's going on here, I think she's got a point. They've dumbed down education by withholding the basic tools and codes of learning, by withholding the content knowledge necessary to connect the dots in understanding history and civics, by withholding and demeaning literature that reveals universal human experience, such as the classics and Shakespeare, by destabilizing a child's sense of self and identity. This is the natural byproduct of de-sexing every child. And five, by promoting relational aggression against any child or parent who might resist this totalitarianism. So what do you think about that? It's pretty interesting, huh? You destroy the school system, and then people will do anything in the name of the colony, the hive, the spirit of the hive. All these lefties are automatons. You could come out of the greatest schools in the history of the world, but if you're taught by these methods, you become a robot. 659 Kelly O'Connor, we're going to come back and get into the history of VD. What? No, not venereal disease. We're going to come back and get into the history of the Valentine's Day. All right, no break for you. Something got screwed up on the board, but it'll everything's back to normal now. But we're not going to take a break at 7. All right, let's get into the history of what they call Lupercalia or Valentine's Day. Here we go. Check this out, friends, romantics, cynics. Here is the history of the holidays from the History Channel, history of Valentine's Day. That'll be coming on in just a minute, but I thought that was a good article. And dumb down the school system, destroy people's ability to think on their own, and then you make all of these people into empty vessels of propaganda. There's got to be a reason that so many of these people, they're like zombies, as to use my previous metaphor when I used to watch The Walking Dead day and night. They are zombie-like in their ability to destroy their sense of independence and distinction. All right, here is the history of Valentine's Day.
For all its popularity, history doesn't give us any guarantees as to the origins of Valentine's Day. But we do know it contains vestiges of the early Christian church and ancient Rome. The association between mid-February and romance goes back to a pagan festival known as Lupercalia, likely honoring either Lupa, the she-wolf of Rome, who suckled Romulus and Remus, or Faunus, their god of fertility. The festivities began with an animal sacrifice. Then the ritualistic slapping of young women with strips of the animal's skin and blood to bestow fertility for the coming year. In the 5th century, perhaps in an effort to Christianize the pagan festival, Pope Gelasius declared February 14th as St. Valentine's Day. As for the real St. Valentine, there were reportedly several canonized by the church. Legend has it that one St. Valentine, a defiant Roman priest, lived during the 3rd century AD under Emperor Claudius II. Claudius was an ambitious ruler. His battles required vast armies of men to abandon their young families for long periods of time, resulting in a military that was half-hearted and homesick. So determined was Claudius to stop love from sapping the will of his armies, he banned marriages altogether. Father Valentine thought the ban unjust and defied the emperor, continuing to marry young lovers in secret. The emperor eventually caught on to the priest's actions, arrested him, and sentenced him to death. It is believed that young couples he had secretly wed would visit his cell, passing him flowers and notes through the bars as symbols of their gratitude. The story continues that the condemned Father Valentine fell in love with his jailer's daughter. On February 14th, the day he was executed, it is said he passed the young girl a note. It was signed, "From your Valentine." A tradition was born. Cupid, the winged matchmaker, started out as the Roman god of love, inspired the image of cherubs for Christians, and is now a favorite of card makers and mass marketers. Our modern Valentine's Day, removed from its religious and pagan past, has evolved into one of the most celebrated holidays on the calendar. On average, Americans shower their loved ones with 180 million roses, red ones naturally, and almost 36 million heart-shaped boxes of candy, not to mention all those cards, dinners, and diamonds. All told, the holiday brings in almost $14 billion annually, giving retailers plenty to love as well. But if you're worried that you can't afford to treat your loved one properly next Valentine's Day, take heart. The poets were right. Love is really all you need.
Disgusting. All right, how about some of the ancient history, which I know we went over just a little bit right there, but so what is the... You hear the term Lupercalia. What does that bring to mind? It should bring to mind lupus, lupine, not lupus, the disease, hopefully, but lupine, wolf. So in the beginning of Rome, there's a story that Romulus and Remus, who were these little boys that were abandoned by their mother and were raised by a wolf, the Capitoline wolf, raised them. And then when they got to, they got older, they became emancipated, I guess. And then they went down to lay out the foundation for Rome, the city, the greatest city in the ancient world. And so as Romulus, who the city is named after, is laying out the foundation stones, he's got the lines of the city that are laid out. Remus jumps over the wall, so to speak, and so Romulus goes and kills him, and I think that is, when I was studying this in the past, it struck me as, you know, the Romans were famous for seeing themselves as civilized people, and I think that myth, it kind of illustrates their rejection of barbarianism and their love of civilization. And so, you know, famously they had these water that was shipped in, you know, they built these aqueducts, but they also built public baths. And so they were very clean people. They were industrious. They loved farming, and they loved the idea that they had, which influenced the founding fathers, the colonists. You know, some of the imagery was the love of the independent farmer who raised enough to support himself and his family. And, okay, so here's a little more on Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. I don't think I finished that thought, by the way. Romulus kills Remus because Remus rejects the city. He disrespects the city. He jumps over the wall. He doesn't come through the opening, and therefore he turns his back on civilization. That was what I got out of it. Anyway, here we go.
St. Valentine, officially known as St. Valentine of Rome, is a 3rd century Roman saint widely associated with courtly love. He is the patron saint of affianced couples, engaged couples, epilepsy, happy marriages, love, and young people. St. Valentine is often represented in pictures with birds and roses, and his feast day is celebrated on February 14th. Although much of St. Valentine's life is not reliably known, many different legends are attributed to him. Valentine and his faith were often put to the test. At one point in his life, he was told to restore a judge's blind daughter's sight to prove the validity of Jesus, and Valentine did just that. St. Valentine was later arrested for trying to convert people to Christianity. He was sent to Rome under Emperor Claudius II. Stories tell that St. Valentine was imprisoned for marrying Christian couples and aiding Christians being persecuted by Claudius. Claudius and Valentine got along very well until Valentine attempted to convert him to Christianity. Claudius became enraged and sentenced Valentine to death, demanding he renounce his faith or be beaten with clubs and beheaded. St. Valentine refused and was executed outside the Flaminian Gate on February 14, 269. One variation of St. Valentine's life states that while imprisoned, he healed a jailer's blind daughter, and on the day of his execution, he left her a note signed, "Your Valentine." Historical accounts claim Valentine's Day was created to overpower the pagan holiday Lupercalia, and exactly when the holiday became associated with romance is not widely agreed upon. Relics of St. Valentine can be found all over the world, including Friar John Spratt's gift of a small vessel tinged with St. Valentine's blood from Pope Gregory XVI in 1836, now located in Dublin, Ireland. To learn more about St. Valentine, visit Catholic.org. And if St. Valentine inspires you,
Catholic.org. I guess he was a Catholic. A little bit too early to be a Catholic, to be honest, but all right, here's a little bit more. Catholic Church doesn't really come into its own as we understand it before the 700s. All right, so a little more on St. Valentine.
Flowers, candy.
Well, actually, okay, so let's skip this one and go to the next one in my list, which is the pagan origin of Valentine's Day. This is very exciting. This is very exciting. Here we go.
This is standing.
Well, maybe not. All right, so I've got like 50 clips here, and I'm remembering which ones had the most the best impression on me. And this is Roman predecessor of Valentine's Day, Lupercalia, February 15th, a pagan fertility ritual. This is exciting. The wolf in the background. Would you believe, don't hate me, but I've got one more that's better than this. I don't know why I saved 20 of them on my page, but this is probably the best one right here. Historia Civilis. This is a website just on ancient Rome. And this has got some great stuff on it. So they go to the cave of the Capitoline wolf where Romulus and Remus were to celebrate this. This is, okay, so you're talking about a giant civilization that doesn't have Christianity to define itself, so it defines itself out of paganism. So it takes something that, you know, the average person would find ridiculous, the being, you know, the city founded by two orphans and whose mother was a wolf, and this is the foundation that they come from.
Their holiday, Lupercalia. Lupercalia was a festival that may have been celebrated for about 1,200 years. Let's just let that sink in for a minute. The roots of this festival were ancient, even to the Romans living during the Republic. The festival began on February 15th in the Lupercal Cave on the Palatine Hill. In Latin, Lupercal, Lupa, or Lupine simply means wolf. The Lupercal Cave is a site where, according to myth, the twins Romulus and Remus, the eventual founders of the city of Rome, were abandoned, later to be found and suckled by a she-wolf. Even after a millennia, the festival always began in this same cave. The ritual itself began as a fairly private affair, with two colleges of priests alone in the cave. Each priestly college was hereditary, kept within a family. One college of priests belonged to the Quintilii, who were, according to tradition, descended from the followers of Romulus. The other college belonged to the Fabii, who were descended from the traditional followers of Remus. In a strange quirk of history, the Quintilii, who were the descendants of Rome's first king and the man who eventually gave Rome his name, were actually a fairly obscure noble family. On the other hand, the Fabii, who were descended from the followers of Romulus's slain twin brother, were one of the most famous families in all of Rome. After the two priestly families gathered in the Lupercal Cave, they would begin with a private feast and lots of wine. After this meal, these tipsy priests would sacrifice several goats and a dog and offer them to the gods. The sacrifice of a dog is noteworthy here. The Romans never sacrificed dogs. If you consider that Lupercalia simply means wolf festival, it doesn't take a stretch to see that the dog was a symbolic stand-in for a wolf. After the sacrifice, two young men were brought forward, standing in for Romulus and Remus, and a bloody knife was rubbed on their foreheads. Then one of the priests would immediately wash off the blood with goat's milk. The symbolism here seems obvious. The violent acts of the founders of the city are forgiven and washed away by milk from a simple agrarian lifestyle, which the Romans always idealized. If that was all that Lupercalia was, it would be a fairly conservative, normal Roman festival. Feasts and animal sacrifice were fairly common. However, after the priests left the cave, this festival took on a life of its own. The priests of the Quintilii and Fabii would take the dead goats and fashion whips with their hides. Yes, whips. Then the priests took off all of their clothes. Some accounts say that they constructed small loincloths out of the goat hide to cover themselves, but others say that they remained totally naked. Plutarch says that they wore loincloths, so let's go with that. The priests from these two families would then exit the cave, still drunk, wearing loincloths, and proceed to run up and down the crowded city streets like maniacs. When the priests encountered people on the street, they would hit them with their newly constructed goat whip. This may sound horrific, but my suspicion is that the whips were never designed to really hurt anybody. They probably made a slapping sound rather than a snapping sound. There's never a mention of any blood or anybody in any pain whatsoever. From all accounts, people actually wanted to get hit. Getting whipped by one of the Lupercal priests was supposed to bring good luck and make men and women extra fertile and ease the pain of childbirth. There are accounts of women brazenly running up to the nearly naked priests and intentionally allowing themselves to be hit. Our sources kind of drop hints that they thought this was a bit unsporting. It seems that the onlookers were supposed to at least pretend that the whips hurt and look like they were trying to get away. By all accounts, the city was filled with laughter the entire evening. It was one of Rome's favorite holidays. And why wouldn't it be? It's my favorite Roman holiday, too. These men were famous, drunk, naked, and hitting strange women with pieces of dead goat. What's not to like?
All right, we'll take a little break here. And I think I might have one more for you. But anyway, I've also got a rant on why men shouldn't be involved in this Valentine's Day stuff from a MG Tao. Men going their own way, I think, is this guy might be a precursor. In the same way Romulus was a precursor to Rome. We'll be right back. 716 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450. It's 7:20, and the weather report had said that we might be expecting rain today. It was raining when I came in this morning, so I think we've already established that. Now, here is a little bit more information on the fertility element in the Lupercalia Festival of Ancient Rome. And here's the wolves howling. These are liberal wolves howling for Trump's blood.
In today's video, I'll talk about a Roman festival that is often described as the predecessor of St. Valentine's Day, though I have to say the similarities are quite limited. I'm talking about the Lupercalia. On February 15th, a fertility ritual would take place, starting at the Lupercal, a cave on the Palatine Hill in Rome. According to Roman mythology, that cave was the exact cave where Romulus, the legendary founder of Rome, and his twin brother Remus were suckled by a she-wolf. The story goes as follows. There was a girl called Rea Silvia, whose father used to be king, but he was dethroned by her cruel uncle. To prevent Rea Silvia from having children, the new king forced her to become a Vestal Virgin. Vestal Virgins were priestesses of the goddess Vesta, who, as the name indicates, were forced to refrain from sexual activities. One day, Rea Silvia was taking a nap in a grove that was sacred to the god Mars. As she was lying there, the war god himself appeared before her, and he took advantage of her. Rea Silvia ended up pregnant from her divine encounter and gave birth to two baby boys, Romulus and Remus. But Rea Silvia's account of what had happened could not convince her wicked uncle. The boys posed a great threat to him, as they could one day, when they were old enough, make a claim to the throne, so they had to disappear. The king ordered his servants to throw the twins in the river Tiber. But with a little help from the god Tiberinus, the personification of the river Tiber, they survived. They were found on the riverbank by a she-wolf who took pity on them and took them to a nearby cave to suckle them, until they were found by two shepherds. The cave was named Lupercal, as Lupa means she-wolf in Latin. So on the Lupercalia, dogs and goats were sacrificed in the Lupercal, and priests would conduct the following ritual. After two young men of noble birth were brought to them, the priests would touch the foreheads of these young men with the blood-stained knife that was used in the sacrifices. Then, they would wipe off the blood with wool dipped in milk. After this, the two young men had to laugh as a part of the ritual. Next, the skins of the goats that were sacrificed were cut into strips. Armed with these goat skin strips, two, or later three, teams of young men ran around the city, stark naked, striking anyone that got in the way. Being struck by these luperci, as they were called, was believed to increase fertility and ease childbirth, so some women deliberately tried to get hit.
All right. I'm not certain how this is coming over the airwaves, so the recording level on this is so low. Thanks for, if you haven't tuned out already, thanks for your patience. But here is here's a minister going after the pagan origins of Valentine's Day, which is kind of entertaining. And this guy is German, which only adds to the comedic element. All right. Do you think of a Christian holiday, Easter or whatever, as a pagan origin that makes it pagan? Number one question. Number two, do you think that also puts an evil element into people's lives? Just curious. Anyway, here's Pagan Origins of Valentine's Day.
And now, evangelist Norbert Link.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to our Standing Watch program. On February 14, many people will be celebrating in one way or another Valentine's Day. And they may not really think about the origin of that day. Today in this program, I'd like to shed some light on the true history of Valentine's Day. And you can do the same. You can just go to the internet and plug in history or pagan history, Valentine's Day, and you will get much information. For instance, here is the website of history.com telling you this. While some believe that Valentine's Day is celebrated in the middle of February to commemorate the anniversary of Valentine's death or burial, others claim that the Christian Church may have decided to place St. Valentine's feast day in the middle of February in an effort to Christianize the pagan celebration of Lupercalia. Celebrated at the Ides of February or February 15, Lupercalia was a fertility festival dedicated to Faunus, the Roman god of agriculture, as well as to the Roman founders Romulus and Remus. To begin the festival, members of the Luperci, an order of Roman priests, would gather at a sacred cave where the infants Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, were believed to have been cared for by a she-wolf or Lupa. The priests would sacrifice a goat for fertility and a dog for purification. They would then strip the goat's hide into strips, clip them into the sacrificial blood, and take to the streets, gently slapping both women and crop fields with the goat hide. Far from being fearful, Roman women welcomed the touch of the hides because it was believed to make them more fertile in the coming year. Later in the day, according to legend, all the young women in the city would place their names in a big urn. The city's bachelors would each choose a name and become paired for the year with his chosen woman. These matches often ended in marriage. Lupercalia, translated, means wolf festival. The Telegraph, that British paper, wrote on February 10, 2010, that in ancient Rome, 13, 14, and 15 February were celebrated as Lupercalia, a pagan fertility festival. This seems to be the basis for a celebration of love on this date.
All right. So anyway, this guy goes on to point some fingers at Lupercalia. But do you think it is wrong for Christians to use a date that was established historically? Because what the church did is they came in and they wanted to get the people to stop practicing paganism, so they converted the holidays over. For instance, December the 25th was the day that Roman gods were supposed to have been born on. That was, I had read that in a book. So anyway, here, shifting gears, Mark Rudolph goes against Valentine's Day. And he's hitting pretty hard here. You guys might enjoy this.
Boycott Valentine's Day. Why? Because men spend twice as much on women as women spend on men, as it should be. Well, Mark Rudolph, the author of Man's No-Nonsense Guide to Women, is here to take on him. Is Tanya Acker. And Mark, you say men should keep their wallets closed this Valentine's Day. Why?
Well, first of the thing, Terry, you just right off the bat, you said as it should be, that men should spend twice as much as women. There you go. You just gave a good reason. Look, Valentine's Day is all about her. That's the first reason men should boycott it. The second is that it's expected generosity, which is not only oxymoronic, it's moronic. You know, it's demanded, it's expected, it's contrived, it's commercial, it's forced, it's phony. Those are all good reasons for not doing it. You know, there's a double standard. Women love to be capitalists at work and socialists in their social lives. And what are the two pillars of socialism? Entitlements and redistribution of wealth. from men to women. So this is now you're going to hear an outburst. You're going to hear an outburst from Tanya. And so when you hear this outburst, you'll know why men go along with Valentine's
Day. Okay, let's hear it then, Tanya. Go, Tanya.
I don't know if this is an outburst. I'm just wondering, Mark, who broke your heart so terribly that you've gone to this dark place? I mean, is chivalry that dead? Is it that
it's
awful
completely
to do
dead.
Something nice? Is it that
chivalry,
awful to do something
chivalry
nice for somebody
chivalry,
who you
Tanya,
care about?
Chivalry, Tanya, chivalry is benevolent sexism, which is BS.
Well, I would actually happen to disagree with you as a feminist, as an independent woman, as somebody who supports myself and has for my whole life. I think it's actually nice when a man opens a door or sends a box of chocolate. And by the way, you say that this holiday is all for women. I think most men would tend to disagree. I think that when
I think when men
are gifting their ladies with pricey lingerie, that's not just for the ladies. Like that's something that people can enjoy mutually. I'm sorry that you don't seem to be enjoying
Tanya,
it.
He has a point, Mark.
If you watch TV, you will see that all the commercials are aimed at men. You have jewelry commercials, you have Vermont teddy bears, you have pajama brands.
So you feel like you don't get enough gifts? You don't get enough gifts? Is that what it is? You want more
Tanya,
gifts?
Come on. Everything you buy for Valentine's Day is overpriced. And men, you know, when you're receiving a present on Valentine's Day, you know the man is feeling forced to give it to you. So it's
Should
not really romantic.
Christmas too? Do you want to cancel Christmas as well? Because prices go up around Christmas as well. I mean, do you want to cancel
that holiday? I thought we were talking about Valentine's Day, Tanya.
What about Easter? Look, Valentine's Day
Tanya,
is one
stick to the
I'm
subject.
Not going to disagree with you. I'm not going to disagree with you that, yes, it's become a commercial holiday. Now, having said that, it's one time a year that we set aside to acknowledge some romance in our lives.
And what's wrong with that, Mark?
If you're only getting romance one day a year, you're not attracting very nice men.
I hope not. I didn't say I'm only getting it once a year.
If you're getting romance, you know what? If you're getting romance every day of the year, Tanya, then February 14th is not going
to
mean anything.
It's nice to have a day. It's nice to have a day.
Who cares? All right. Take a break here. Kelly O'Connell. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450. Call in. If you're a doubter, if you're a naysayer on Valentine's Day, 733 on the button. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. You're listening to KOBE. We'll be right back to Shift Gears. All right, so anyway, you may feel like you have to take part in a Valentine's Day. I feel your pain. All right, so weird stories out there, one involving Jerry Sandusky's kid, believe it or not, doing the same type of thing that, the dad became famous for. There's an article in Foreign Policy magazine that's of note, The Blackwater of Jihad. And another interesting article, Kremlin worrying about Trump. And if you go to Foreign Policy and read this, what they'll say is that the Kremlin is not is not into revolution anymore like in the old days, and that they are basically concerned that Trump is a revolutionary, that he's going to overthrow the whole order, that he's going after globalism and all these other things that is going to make him harder to deal with. So you can go check that out. I thought it was a pretty good article. I think it's become clear that Trump and Putin, they might be friendly to one another, possibly, but I think that Trump has never really worked with the guy. Jerry Sandusky's son facing child soliciting charges. Can you believe it?
Jeffrey Sandusky, the son of convicted sex abuser Jerry Sandusky, has been arrested on child sexual abuse charges. That's according to court documents filed today in Pennsylvania. Let's get right to CNN's Sarah Ganim. Sarah, there were felony and misdemeanor charges filed. What do we know about what law enforcement is alleging?
Jake, there are 14 charges against Jeffrey Sandusky involving two girls. They happened several years apart. The charges were uncovered when one of the girls told her father that Sandusky had texted her repeatedly asking her to send him naked photos. The father contacted police. The girl's father contacted police. And in the course of the investigation, the police discovered another girl known as victim number two in the criminal complaint, who said that Jeffrey Sandusky asked her to engage in oral sex with him years before, back in 2013. Both victims say Sandusky tried to use different excuses to get them to participate, saying at one point that he had studied medicine, and another time that he believed one of the victims had shared a nude photo of herself with her boyfriend and he wanted to see it. Around the same time that this was happening, Jeffrey Sandusky was publicly defending his father on child rape charges that he was facing, appearing on a video on YouTube with his mother. Listen to what he said.
Knowing my father's innocent and some of the things that are brought up, hopefully they're taken and actually people will actually listen to and take it to heart.
Jeffrey is one of six adopted children of Jerry Sandusky. Of course, Sandusky is the former Penn State football coach who is serving a 30-year sentence for molesting 10 different boys. 30 men in total have settled lawsuits with Penn State University over sex abuse claims.
And have a little dedication for Jeff Sandusky, son of Jerry.
Proud of my daddy's name. Although his kind of music and mine ain't exactly the same. In my position, if I get stoned and sing all night long, it's a family tradition.
And we'll take a break and be right back. All right, I've got for you one of the most brutal obituaries ever penned. Check it out.
So the family of a man in Galveston, Texas, wrote a scathing obituary of him after he died last month. We're talking about Leslie Ray Charping. He died of cancer, and his daughter wrote this brutally honest obituary. Now, she has asked not to be identified, but she did have this to say.
No services will be held. There will be no prayers for eternal peace and no apologies to the family that he tortured. For someone that knew him and family members that knew him to read that obituary and to see something on there that was a complete lie would have been an insult to everyone that he did bad things to, and there were a lot of them.
Wow. So she says that she appreciates everyone's concern and would have appreciated it more during her childhood.
All right, so what does the obituary say? Leslie Ray Popeye Charping was born in Galveston on November 20th, 1942, and passed away January 30th, 2017, which was 29 years longer than expected and much longer than he deserved. At a young age, Leslie quickly became a model example of bad parenting combined with mental illness and a complete commitment to drinking, drugs, womanizing, and being generally offensive. Leslie enlisted to serve in the Navy, but not so much in a brave and patriotic way, but more as a part of a plea deal to escape sentencing on criminal charges. Leslie's hobbies included being abusive to his family, expediting trips to heaven for the beloved family pets, and fishing, which he was less skilled with than the previously mentioned. Leslie's life served no other obvious purpose. He did not contribute to society or serve his community. And he possessed no redeeming qualities besides quick-witted sarcasm, which was amusing during his sober days. With Leslie's passing, he will be missed only for what he never did, being a loving husband, father, and good friend. Leslie's passing proves that evil does, in fact, die, and hopefully marks a time of healing and safety for all. Woo! That's what I would call a tough obituary. All right, now I know you're feeling depressed, so here's a little bit of Andy Pitt's comedy for you to lighten your load.
Thank you so much. Oh, this is great. This is great. I was hanging out with my sister recently. She's got a face full of Botox now. You know, the anti-wrinkle injection. Now, this stuff paralyzes your facial muscles. So now she looks sort of younger, but her stories are really confusing. See, like, you guys, the entire plane ride from California, little boy behind me is kicking my seat. Finally, I'd had enough. I shot him such a look. I was like, oh, I think he got the message right there. You know, I would rather have a wrinkly face that I can use. You know what I mean? Like, I'll do this thing. If somebody tells me their job and it's impressive, but I don't want to talk to the person. When I hear the job, I'll just put my eyebrows up, you know? What do you do? I work with underprivileged children. That says it all right there. That's an eyebrow up occupation. Sometimes you may need to use the deluxe edition, which is the lower lip and the nod as well. And you know how some you can tell if someone's really embarrassed with their job? If they tell you what they do, and they use the phrase right now before the job. What do you do? Well, right now. I'm auctioning off all of my parents' books on eBay. So I definitely think technology has changed the way we live. You know, one thing it's changed a lot is the way we tell each other to stay in touch, right? Because there's a hand signal for everything. People with cell phones are like, people with email go. You think it was always like that? Like when we only had the telegraph where people walking around going.
Andy Pitts for you. All right. So let's go back over some of the stuff we covered. It looks like the Oroville Dam may live. They're trying to rebuild the hole in it. And, okay, so the history of Lupercalia, it started off being a celebration of the twins who started Rome and then ended up being St. Valentine's Day. and some of the other things that we covered. Well, we covered a lot of Lupercalia, but Flynn is out. Now, the Black Y, we do have a phone call, by the way. Thanks for the call to the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Tom.
Tom, good morning to you. Hope you're well. What's on your mind?
Happy Valentine's Day there, Kelly.
Thanks. Happy VD to you, too. What else is 1. Going on?
1.6 million awarded to a couple that got thrown to the ground by a police officer. Did you see that?
Yeah, and the lady's face looked pretty beat up.
Mm-hmm. That's money like flushed down the toilet by our police department, huh?
Well, they have, you know, I mean, they have insurance, don't they?
Yeah, us, isn't it?
I think there's insurance coverage, but I don't know if it would be covered by that. But I can barely hear you, Tom.
I'm at McDonald's up by Highway 70. I'm a little interference.
I hear dogs are barking. I hope it's not a pack of wild dogs that are trying.
It's not Mike with me.
Okay. All right.
Happy Valentine's Day, Mike. All right.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Hopefully not a pack of wild dogs trying to steal his food. It is still a bad economy, even though Trump is in there. The Blackwater of Jihad, a consortium of elite, well-paid fighters from across the former Soviet Union, are training jihadis in Syria. Their business model could go global. And so interesting. You know, Russia is really a wild card. I think it would be good to have them on our a little bit more on our side, although they are never going to be a complete ally because they're too much, you know, we have mutual interests that we're kind of fighting over. But don't forget, in the Russian part of the world, there are a large number of people of a Muslim extraction over there already, and Russia has in the past, and certainly I'm sure today even, has an extraordinary amount invested in not just military, but counterintelligence and special units. And they have their own problems with Islam, Islamic attacks, terrorist attacks. And so the idea that some of these people that have been trained in the dark arts are going and raising up an army of Blackwater, or I guess you would call them, you know, mercenaries, to fight for the wars of Islamic terrorists is pretty scary. Other news. Let me do a quick summary of the news for you. The Kremlin downplays Flynn resignation. Moscow accuses USA of paranoia. Anti-Russian agenda. Fears Trump assassination. See, I don't think Russia is as close to Trump as people think. I think they're trying to take the measure of the man himself as well. Flynn has resigned, as we mentioned. Jim Rogers, who is a former partner of George Soros, prophesying the death of cash, total government control of spending. It's weird. Students wearing white pins to remind them of white privilege. You shameful cucks. Apple value at $700 billion. Shares closing at record high. Cars mysteriously catching fire inside Disneyland garage. Could be maybe Mickey Mouse has become a meth head. Brussels gears up for high stakes challenge to U.S. border tax plan. Don't have to study that one a little bit. Biggest case in World Trade Organization history. That's interesting. India to launch 104 satellites in record mission. Burger King sex toys and adult meals for Valentine's Day. What the? Dems demand to know who else in White House's national security risk. Brazilian town embraces universal income experiment in which everybody gets paid whether they work or not. China is investing more in Hollywood. Chinese weapons reaching near parity with the West. The question is coming up, forced human microchipping. Everybody has to get a microchip. Man accused of engaging in sex act with a dog turns himself in. school district contemplating using students as janitors to cut costs. Athens is setting up its first mosque since the Ottoman Empire. There has been, by the way, no rise in deportation as regards American enforcement of immigration laws. In one Georgia school district, 140 student languages. Well, I'm sure that's easy to deal with. Seattle judge set to move forward on Trump immigration case. And inflation seeing biggest gain in 4 years. Palm Beach is getting ready for the party of the century. That's where, isn't that where Trump has his house? Dam crisis, wake up call for aging California water system warning signs. You know, the Californians did a real good job in the 50s and the 60s putting together a water preservation, a system to get water around the state. And then the environmentalists stood up against them. And so they need to get back to putting more of these, instead of making super giant reservoirs, make more reservoirs down in the south. They say every time it rains an inch in Los Angeles, which has been quite a bit recently, they lose a billion gallons into the ocean. Valentine's Day banned for some in Asia. Republican struggles to replace Obamacare, deja vu all over again. Congressman claiming town halls are hijacked by leftists, being imported, will not do anymore. Greece could ditch EU currency for U.S. dollar. It's about time, my friends. Times Square Mickey Mouse charged with stealing from tourists. That's shocking. Older judges and vacant seats give Trump huge power to shape courts. Murders and robbers of drivers in Brazil force Uber to rethink cash strategy. Detroit has now become America's unhealthiest city. I didn't even know Detroit existed anymore. And San Francisco and Salt Lake City among the healthiest. And there's a girl who won the lotto at 17 in England, Jane Park. She's 21 now. She got breast implants, was happy about that. But she says, what do I have to live for? She goes, sure, I have money, but there's no purpose in my life. And she used to have a job and be happy. Be careful what you wish for. All right. Thanks for tuning in. Happy VD. Happy Valentine's Day, not venereal disease. Careful, friends. Careful. And don't forget that if you don't have somebody today, a sweetheart, you're just saving money. You're just planning for the future. Who cares about Valentine's Day? Thanks a lot. Thanks for tuning in. Kelly O'Connell, I'm Las Cruces. You're listening to KOBE. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
And the lips you break have no place to stay. Me old lady, taught me to weep and moan. Me old lady, taught me to weep and moan. It's got what it takes to make my magic as well. Oh, well.